let's look ahead 2 weeks. This week we finish with nature. Next week is an interval. And in 2 weeks we start with ritual. And we want to be prepared somewhat because ritual has a lot of amperage, has a lot of oomph. And ritual right away throws us into existence. Right away, ritual calls out to our bodies. Ritual is a visceral field of inquiry. And without a little preparation, we can get swept away very easily. So looking ahead to 2 weeks, we want to reformulate for ourselves that in order to keep track of the shape of ritual, which is much more difficult to keep track of than nature, though ritual is a reduced selection of nature for us because we are immersed in it so frequently in terms of habit, we need to make an extra effort in order to educate ourselves in terms of ritual, which is not there for nature. We can give ourselves to the participation of nature, but when we do the same thing, when we innocently give ourselves to the participation of ritual, ritual takes us over. And so we need to have a little bit of perspective. It's called foresight. The Greek word was pronous. And the ancient saying was that pronous was the entrance to the temple of wisdom. It was the lobby. And so one has to be very circumspect about ritual. So in order to give ritual a shape by which we can inquire as to its structure, inquire as to what is really going on, what is its nature, we need to prepare ourselves. And what I have chosen out of all of the techniques that men and women have developed on this planet, around this star, the best technique is the technique of the mask. The mask gives us a way of having a little bit of distance and not reducing ritual to a subject matter, which we then tyrannize by preemptive ideas. This is an education that tries to respect the DNA sequence, the way in which learning actually unfolds. And we must guard against presupposing by powerful intellectual ideas that come much later and would only distort the true beginnings and foundations of learning, of education. But at the same time, with ritual, we have to guard against being swept up by it. So we have to defend ourselves against preemptive symbolization, against the concept coming in and tyrannizing. And we also have to guard ourselves against being habitually encased and in between all the vicissitudes of language become pitfalls if not handled, the British used to use the term proper way. What is a proper way? The way that we're going to handle language is in the way in which language flames out of action, out of doing. And it's as simple as the old Homeric motif. You go out and have adventures, and you can't wait to tell someone about it. It is as simple as that and as complex as that. And we will see today that the roots of Jane Goodall's studies of chimpanzees show us in a very arcane way why it is that language is generally conversational rather than limited to yells. And we'll see some of this structure. But the making of masks is important in keeping track of ritual. And we're going to make two masks, a pair of masks, that are related to each other in a specific way. The first mask is a mask from outside that comes into us, and that is a mask of food, any food, or it could be a liquid, something that we drink. Something in your nutrition that comes from the outside, that comes from nature, and comes into your body. So that the way in which nature enters your body is covered by this mask of food. It's the process of food coming in. The second mask is a mask of feeling. Some feeling that you recognize in yourself that occurs frequently. Frequently enough so that you can recognize it and you can put a version of your face on it. A mask of feeling. And this mask of feeling is a polarity to the mask of food. The mask of food is from outside coming in, nature into the body. The mask of feeling is from the body outside. The body projects it out into nature. So food and feeling are going to be a pair characterized by this pair of masks. Now the mask on food should be brought at the very beginning of ritual. So 2 weeks from today, try and bring with you your mask of food. Choose some food. I once made a mask of watermelon. And I had the contours like a cubist semi-Picasso look of watermelon rinds, the green and the light white and the pink and the dark seeds, but overlaid, and then larger seeds strategically placed for eyes and so forth. A mask of food, bring it with you at the very beginning, ritual one. The mask of feeling, bring it with you at ritual four. So there'll be 3 weeks in between. So that the first month of ritual will be punctuated by two masks. Ritual one, the mask of food. Ritual four, the mask of feeling. Then we will, over the next 4 weeks, contemplate how those two masks come together. And that in coming together, the inner and the outer, through two interfaces, the inner and the outer, nature and ritual, are delimited more and more, and the tension between them grows so that the mask of food and the mask of feeling, backed up to each other, will produce, finally, just before contact, the thinnest imaginable space, and that thinnest imaginable space, still separating them, yet linked by enormous tension, that thinnest possible space will be the first membrane of our personality. And that point at which our two masks, whatever it is that you make, brought together in this technique, that point will be the first point on a sphere of your true nature, of your real personality. Now, this seems at first to be a very peculiar technique. Why would we seek to discover our real personality by making masks? Let's review just for a second an ancient wisdom story of how masks came to be. I'll choose out of the world's heritage of things, I'll choose the old myth of how masks came to be from the Iroquois Indians. The Iroquois, part of a great confederation in northern New York State, the six civilized tribes. Their Confederation model was the basis upon which Benjamin Franklin first imagined the form of the colonies coming together and forming a united country. So the Iroquois were not at all primitive savages. Some of the greatest orators in human history were Iroquoian chiefs. Their myth of how masks came to be made, and the Iroquois called masks, the name translated means false face, that a mask is a false face. Not that the mask is a false face, but that the archetypal origin of masks is due to a character who can be called false face. And the way that the Iroquois myth runs, the myth of masks, is that God created such a beautiful, harmonious world that the first being that became self-conscious in this world felt that all of the world was due to him, that he was self-conscious of the whole world and everything was so beautifully fluid that it must be his creation. And God, the great creator, appeared as a stranger to this person, to this first figure. And sensing a kind of competition, this first person decided that he would show his powers off to this stranger. And so there ensued this kind of demonstration between the two of who had the bigger magic. And God, in order to wake up from this ignorant pride and arrogance, this first creature moved a mountain, rock, ledge, exactly in back of this figure. And when the first figure turned around suddenly to go and make some magic display, he ran into this rock ledge, the nose bent, the lips protruded, the tongue came out between the teeth, the expression went awry, and the creator froze that split second distorted false face and said to this demiurgic, arrogant first creature, "You will always wear this face in token of your arrogance. And when man comes along as the epitome of creation, the true epitome of creation, you will always have this false face to remind man not to fall into the same arrogant trap. And also, concomitantly, you will always need to be there as a helper for man. Whenever man needs help for purification, for curing, for transitions, variants of you will need to be there, and you will have efficacy to help man. You will be known as his helper." Now, there's a little bit more, but you can see that the Iroquois origin of mass, very wise. There are many books now, Claude Levi Strauss's The Way of the Mask. There are many books out that are very sophisticated about masks. Just accept it from me that this is a very seminal exercise. It will have no effect whatsoever if you do not do it. It doesn't matter how well you do it, or how sloppily you do it, so much as that you do it. But to the extent that you give yourself to this project, that you make those masks as carefully as you can, to that extent it will be of service to you and will be a helper in the transitions to come and will be a poignancy of realization. And the poignancy of realization is always the spark of the place of insight. And when we get next year to vision, we will find that that kind of spark of insight is Promethean indeed. It lights a whole fire that is the refining flame of differential growth. Now, these two masks, in a way, have a characteristic relationality to the false valuation of process in the human world. The false valuation of process in the human world is for about 3,000 years now, 3,000 to 3,500 years, has been characterized by money, by coined money. And we can take it as an example, the gold coin. Originally, wealth was kept track of in a societal way by lumps of raw gold that had a stamp on them, and the stamp was simply some kind of mark for whichever king owned them. For instance, bullion from the New World came into Spain and was marked with an S for Spain and two lines for the Pillars of Hercules through which that money came to Spain. And so the S with the two lines became the sign for the dollar. It was a carryover of the most ancient qualities of just stamping gold with some kind of insignia. The minting of gold into a circular plane and putting the portrait of the owner on the coin was concomitant with the rise of world-class egotistical arrogance. A true mask that accompanied the false valuation of process in this world. Perhaps the most famous of all ancient wisdom sayings was when once offered a gold coin, Jesus replied to the briber, "Whose face is on this coin? This belongs to him. It has nothing whatsoever to do with the kingdom where I am at work." So this quality, and incidentally, if you get interested in this, there is a whole section of Norman Old Brown's Life Against Death where he talks about money and feces, the anal retentiveness of the psychotic quality of false valuing process so that it is arrogantly held onto so as to ensure manipulation is perfect and complete. One of the examples of the way in which the portrait on a gold coin tyrannizes the valuation of a process occurs in Moby Dick. In Moby Dick, the section for this week is called the quarterdeck. Let's just see how it unfolds for a few minutes. Chapter 36, Moby Dick, the reading for this week. And remember, we're reading Moby Dick or the Odyssey throughout the whole year, just little section by little section, distributing like a snowshoe on deep snow, distributing our weight over a whole year so as to allow these long, year-long journeys to carry us completely through a form which we will find in a couple of weeks is called the ritual year. Or sometimes in astronomy now is called the annual year, since some of us have grown out of ritual. Here's how the quarterdeck reads in excerpt. Just a few sentences, few paragraphs. In parentheses, under the chapter, "Enter Ahab," semicolon, "then all." So it's a scene, the blank quarterdeck on a ship. Ahab enters the scene. Then all the crew enters the scene. It was not a great while after the affair of the pipe that one morning shortly after breakfast, Ahab, as his wont, ascended the cabin gangway to the deck. There was there most sea captains usually walk at that hour, as country gentlemen after the same meal take a few turns in the garden. Soon his steady, ivory stride was heard, as to and fro he paced his old rounds upon planks so familiar to his tread that they were all over dented like geological stones with a peculiar mark of his walk. Did you fixedly gaze, too, upon that ribbed and dented brow? There also you would see still stranger footprints, the footprints of his one unsleeping, ever-pacing thought. But on the occasion in question, those dents looked deeper, even as his nervous step that morning left a deeper mark. And so, full of his thought was Ahab, that at every uniform turn that he made, now at the mainmast, now at the binnacle, you could almost see that thought turn in him as he turned, and pace in him as he paced, so completely possessing him, indeed, that it all but seemed the inward mold of every outer movement. So in this section of Moby Dick, and you can see how masterfully Melville writes, Ahab takes out a gold $16 doubloon, Spanish doubloon, shows it to the crew after he gets them riled up. He asks them, what do you do when you're up in the crow's nest and you see a whale? Well, you sing out, whale ahoy. And what would you do if you saw a special whale that we're looking for? And he gets around to the subject of Moby Dick, the one thought alone that he has in his mind, the thought that shapes the portrait of the brow, the true face on the coin is not the face of the king who minted it, but it's Ahab's face, for he takes the top maul from the carpenter and he nails this gold coin to the masthead. And later on in Moby Dick, when they're completely immersed in the doldrums without a breath of air for days, almost weeks on end, that gold coin glows, as Melville says, like another pagan sun blinding the men and almost calling out to them to recognize that some curse had been sealed upon the Pequod and its crew. And one of the men says, pluck that doubloon from the mast and throw it to the sea so it'll let us go. This is the money. This is the mask. This is the way in which ritual keeps us bound. But what we're going to look at today is the realization that ritual must bind. It's truthful. Structure and purpose is to bind. And so it is not the fault of ritual at all, but the fault, if one must locate a fault, is in a false education that fails to distinguish for people the place that ritual has, the necessity for existence to be exactly what it is and nothing else, the necessity for social bonding to be in certain patterns that carry through and allow for existence and bodies to continue in a recognizable shape individually and collectively, and that ritual is necessary for this. but that one must move past ritual into another dimension. And we'll see that that further dimension is the development of language. That language has a ritual origin, but like ritual taking nature to another level, language takes ritual to an even higher level, more comprehensible. And that the roots of all this, the beginnings of all this, predate our species by tens of millions of years. It is not some peculiar trait of some peculiar kind of human beings. It's not even a trait peculiar to Homo sapiens sapiens, not even to the whole genus Homo that's been around for 4 or 5 million years. But even in the chimpanzees who separated out at least 50 to 70 million years ago from the line that led to us, even Jane Goodall's 35 years of observations of chimpanzees showed the deep structural origins of the way in which ritual and nature have a interplay, just like the interplay between one and zero. It is completely universal and completely dominates the structural reality of the ratios of process. Now, in talking about female chimpanzees, Jane Goodall points out that there are several qualities observable decade after decade that at first one would not suppose is the case and yet is the case. That in a chimpanzee community, their territoriality is limited for the males. Males always stay in the community that they are born in. Parturition is a geographical destiny for the male, for the chimpanzee. They do not leave the community of their birth. Yet, they ceaselessly patrol the boundaries, the edges of that community. They ceaselessly explore what we will come to recognize one of the most powerful terms of structural anthropology, a term, liminality. And we will see that Victor Turner, Levi Strauss, a number of great French anthropologists have brought out the concept of liminality. That is to say that boundaries are sometimes scintillating. They're not drawn with a knife edge. Though the boundaries are not drawn with a knife edge, the transition across the boundary is knife edge. And one of the most peculiar qualities is that male chimpanzee patrolling bands will come to a liminal barrier of their territory, and right up to that barrier will have confidence and easygoingness, and as soon as they take one step beyond what they recognize as the liminality, they become extremely cautious and apprehensive, nervous, ready to fight, ready to kill, ready to kidnap, ready to rape. That it's a trigger for violence, which is endemic to that species, endemic indeed to life forms. She observes that it's only an appearance. It's a token appearance to think that a stream or a ravine is the boundary of a community. And yet, as soon as one sees where the liminality trigger is, it's very frequently a stream. It's very frequently the very bottom, the V, the bottom of a ravine. So that geographical features seemingly are the boundaries, but the true boundaries are a liminality which allows for a trigger of a response which is identical, or we should say similar, between individual and group. The individual members, the group as a whole, change. She points out that approaching to the boundary, male chimpanzees on patrol will only after crossing the liminality into some other territory will then have this trigger of conflict availability. The propensity for violence. So that the chimpanzee communities for the males are their bubble. The only way in which communities have interchange is through females. That females are the only ones who are able to leave the communities of their birth and join and be accepted. They join other communities and those other communities accept them. So that females are the ways in which systems of chimpanzee communities become interrelated. And after 35 years, Jane Goodall was able to see that one could not talk about chimpanzee communities without talking about the system of social interreactions of many communities together, because the linkage of the female gave the true shape of the intercommunity spread. And that one would never know this, one would never learn this by examining the males. They do not give this information. The study of them does not divulge the way in which intercommunity systems develop. She writes that the female chimpanzees may transfer out of their community of birth and allow for this overlap, and that one notices in the sexuality of female chimpanzees that before they come into fertility, they already are able to display. The genital regions swell and achieve a kind of a pinkish color. And that in the normal procreative sustaining of the community, a period of fertility of 1 to 5 weeks would be plenty, and yet they remain in a swollen state for 10 to 16 weeks. And that also, after parturition, after having given birth, it's about 3.5 years before there's any further swelling, before sexuality resumes. Though right after conception, for about 3 to 4 weeks, there is still a continuance of swelling. It then subsides and does not come back for about 3.5 years. She observes that the female chimpanzee, therefore, is not by nature completely limited to procreation, that sexuality serves a social function among the chimpanzees. That, in fact, the female chimpanzee's extended sexuality is the only way by which social bonding is able to transform and extend itself beyond what would be a very limited, fragile, brittle male domination. That, in contrast to the female chimpanzees, the male chimpanzees are constantly prepossessed by the need for dominance by the need for aggression, for rivalry leading to some kind of pecking order, and that any overlap of their communities is always a source of conflict. That though they patrol the boundaries in a way patrol them also. That there's this reciprocality among the male. That male sexuality in this kind of primate is completely dominated by the need to tend boundaries, and those boundaries tend you. Whereas the female is permeable to those boundaries. She does not recognize any kind of a pressure situation in going through the liminality. Does not recognize the need to have a conflict response when doing so. And can join a new community and keep intact all of her valuations, her perspectives. And so chimpanzee communities have a large system of interrelationality purely on the basis of the female. That the females, as we talked about before, in Jane Goodall's investigations, occupy themselves with centers, but that those centers that they preoccupy themselves with are mobile, like a movable feast. Whereas the males are preoccupied with boundaries and patrolling those boundaries, but those boundaries are not movable. They tend to be very stayed, very set. Now, the peculiarity here is that as soon as male chimpanzees, individually or a group, have passed a liminality and are ready for conflict, the probability is that they will attack strangers. In fact, the perception of a stranger in a transliminal geographical situation is a trigger for attack of strangers. The very perception that here is a stranger in this transliminal situation is like a cue for attack. If the stranger is identified with a female, the female, if attracted, could be kidnapped and brought into the community. This kind of territoriality does not extend to the female chimpanzee. It is a, as we would say today, it's a gender preoccupation. The female, quoting Jane Goodall, perhaps I should say this before I give the quote to her, the nature of sexuality, that is to say sexuality and nature, and this kind of investigation, while centered on procreation, is bounded by the liminalities of ritual bonding, and that this center and this periphery together are like a target ratio, and that this target ratio's purpose is integration, including more and more other communities, intercommunity, all individuals. So that the purpose of all of this is to advance integration. The quotation from Jane Goodall, this is from her great Harvard classic, The Chimpanzees of Gombe. Towards the end of this tome, she writes, having tracked at this point for 19 years the estrus cycles among female chimpanzees, she writes about the infertile cycles, the 3.5 year post-parturation cycle of infertility. of not swelling. These infertile cycles benefit the female socially and biologically. She becomes increasingly integrated into adult society, is able to travel safely with males to peripheral areas, learns there in those explorations of new food resources, and perhaps becomes better aware of the dangers of intercommunity conflict. She also gets more grooming and more frequent shares of meat. And the child of an older female will also benefit as a result of his mother's increased sociability, so that her swelling, in a way, serves as a sexual bargaining point, the price she has to pay in the occasional undesired courtship or the forcible recruitment, it's a scientific name for rape, by neighboring males, the risk of injury during promiscuous group mating, which in turn may delay fertilization, and a good deal of minor discomfort. But as a complement to her sexuality, that cycle, when the estrous cycle is dormant, allows for her the exploration of wider worlds. And she sees the boundary areas for the first time without jeopardy, for she experiences no jeopardy at all, and sees the male limitations, sees the community limitations as not limitations, but simply as movable walls, or perhaps a better way to say it, as membranes, that the shape of the community is held by a membrane, which is permeable, rather than by a wall. The males only see a wall. The females see a membrane. So that even on level of 70 million years ago, evolution already was showing a sexual paredness where the female awareness of membrane osmosis was polarized against the male containment. And that only by a reciprocality between the two was it possible for there to be anything like an abstract mediation, but also anything like an ongoingness of community. So that the males learned from the females, just as the females learned from the males, that there are times in the development, for instance, the female's sexuality extends far beyond just the simple need for procreation. And in those times, a single male very frequently will be with a single female together for up to a month together, and spending time together as a pair. This, in distinct contrast to the normal nature of the males going off by themselves and the females staying with the young in the center of the territory. At that time, the male learns the female's point of view, learns those qualities. And part of the shared learning process that's formative is nutrition, the sharing of foraging together for long periods, the sharing of food sources together. So that one can say nutrition, like natural sexual cycles, bond the annual year, the ritual year. That sexual polarity in existence seeks integration through exchange. And so ritual has a reciprocity structure. And out of ritual's reciprocity structure, language or myth, mythic language founded on this, founded on the reciprocity structure of ritual, will naturally prefer conversation to mere interjection. And that on the basis of conversation favored over mere interjection, on level of symbols, dialogue will characterize language rather than yells. Let's take a break. So we're ready to make the transition to ritual, and we're aware that in making that transition to ritual, we're going to be carrying a paired caliper, and that that paired caliper has many forms, and one of the forms universally that it has for organic life is sexuality. And that this paired caliper is like having two lines of force that are parallel, and as they travel parallel, they have a peculiar quality of delineating form and process, which is characteristic of, let's give two examples. One of the characteristics, this illustration from one of our books on the double helix, the structure of DNA having parallel phosphate backbones that hold together the double helix, and that this pair of phosphate backbones on the DNA structure is very similar to the way in which light diffraction in crystals takes place. This is from a book, Crystals in Light, Figure 2, Chapter 2, 17, Figure 2, 17. And always the diffraction. Why is it like this with a pair of lines diffracting so that you get in between the pair of lines, you get a sine wave of light energy? Figure 217 shows what happens when a beam of X-rays meets a crystal. Here the horizontal lines represent two layers of atoms in the crystal, seen edge on. To simplify the picture, only one atom in each layer is shown. The distance between the two layers is labeled D. A beam of X-rays represented by rays A and B, incident upon the surface of the crystal, that is to say, they come into contact with the surface of the crystal. The wavelength is lambda, indicated by a marker at the position of each wave crest, so that there's a sine wave crest, and you put a lambda at the top of each crest at each apex. This is the frequency of the light beam coming. And the two rays, A and B, of this beam meet the atoms in the two layers and bounce off in all directions. Several are shown. The wavelength markers being properly measured off by on every ray. The two rays start off with their crests and troughs in step, so to speak, in phase. So we say that light is in phase, or energy is in phase. If the troughs, if the apexes are congruent, if the lambdas all occur at the same place. However, the fact that ray B, which penetrates more deeply into the crystal, travels a longer path means that it gets behind. So that only if it gets behind by exactly one wavelength, or exactly two wavelengths, or three, or four, will it come out in phase. Most of the time, in the diffraction, the wavelengths will be out of phase, and you will get scattered light. So that there is a scattering that happens, except at exact numerical intervals, which are exact angles of incidence. And the same is true here in the way in which structures of life and process happen. One can have an initial coherence, but the way in which the diffraction of life scatters energy, usually it's out of phase. And so life has to have, nature, the universe, has to have some way of bringing back into phase, and this is the whole nature of integration. Integration is the propensity of the universe to bring back into phase natural occurring scatteringness. And we will see that in ritual, human rituals are always a bringing back into phase and integration of the natural and normal scattering that goes on. The in phase is to have the relationality between male and female in a configuration which is characteristic of a phase form transition that holds that pairedness in balance. Not as equals, but in ratioed relationality where the two form a complement, where the two form a whole. So that ritual will have this kind of gender characterization to its structure. In order to illustrate this, when we come to ritual in 2 weeks, we're shifting our textbooks again. Instead of The Double Helix by James Watson and Jane Goodall's book on the chimpanzees Through a Window, we'll have these two books, The Navajo Medicine Man Sand Paintings by Gladys Reichard and The Sacred Pipe, Black Elk's Account of the Seven Rites of the Oglala Sioux, as recorded by Joseph Eppes Brown. You'll probably have the paperback version of both. Now, we talked about how with Gladys Reichard's great monograph, we wanted some of the chapters to be read in general, others of the chapters to be read only by women, and others only by men. We're going to take it a step further in The Sacred Pipe. I would like everyone in general to read the first chapter, which is The Gift of the Sacred Pipe. It's not very long. It's page 3 to 9. So The Gift of the Sacred Pipe, talking about the myth behind the calumet and how it came to be in the seven rites, why there are seven, and so forth. Then I would like the women to read chapters 2 and 3 together. Keeping of the soul and the rite of purification. Just the women. And the men, I would like to read just the releasing of the soul, which is this chapter 2, but the second section on page 19. So just the men, page 19 to page 30. And then the crying for a vision, which is chapter 4, page 44. To page 66. So that just the men read releasing the soul and crying for a vision, and just the women, the keeping of the soul and the rite of purification. So that the only way in which the women will hear about the chapters that they did not read are from the men, and the only way that the men will hear about the chapters that they did not read are from the women. Now, this is a diffraction of the experience that you would have by reading it all yourself. So that the women carry a responsibility to deliver to the men the sense of keeping of the soul and purification. And men have a like responsibility to deliver to the women the releasing of the soul and the crying for a vision. So that the crying for a vision and purification can only be exchanged the keeping of the soul and the releasing of the soul can only be exchanged on the basis of reciprocal communication. Now, all of you will read the gift of the sacred pipe, and then all of you will read again the chapter on the sun dance. The very center of the sacred pipe is the sun dance. Blackfoot tribe word for the sun dance, the Okan, the Wiyag Wichipi for the Sioux. We will all stop then on page 100. So the sun dance takes page 67 through 100, and you have plenty of time to read that. You have over a month just to look at that. So begin by reading the gift of the sacred pipe, all of you, and then split off into male and female. Now, in a ritual setting, this splitting into paired groups like this is anthropologically called moieties. And moieties can be on many bases. Right now, we're going to put it on a gender basis for learning purposes, so that the sacred pipe, the section on the sacred pipe as a gift, will be read by all. And then the sun dance, that section, will be read by all. But don't read together the section on the sun dance until we've had a chance to have that sharing, that shared report between the men and the women. Because the men will have only half the story, and the women will have only half the story. In order to get the full story, you will have to communicate to each other. Now, this is a step forward. This is a difference in the education. All through nature, I have done all the speaking. Now, to begin ritual, we're going to have a division, or rather like the famous sociologist Emile Durkheim. One of his great books is called The Division of Labor. And the way in which the division of labor yields a more efficient overall process, able to reach further than what could be with a single system of manufacture. It seems that one of the most productive readers of Emile Durkheim was Henry Ford. The production line works very much more efficiently than the craftsman. One loses something, but one gains in productivity enormously. So we're going to have this division of labor so that along with making your masks, the women will need to get together with each other to find some way to deliver as a group the information contained in keeping the soul and purification. And the men will have to get together. We'll have to include the cameramen so that there's a body of a population there. We'll have to deliver the information on releasing the soul and crying for a vision. Now, the releasing of the soul, the going out for a crying of the vision, is going to the very boundaries, the ritual boundaries of the life process. The keeping of the soul and purification has to do with the very center. One example here. In the Sweat Dance Lodge, in ancient times, in originating times, in high sacred ceremonies like the sun dance, the very center of the sun dance sweat lodge was dug out and removed at some distance and made into a mound. On that mound of removed center was placed the wood to make the fire to heat the stones. Those stones were taken on the very path that was used to remove the center to make that mound. And those stones were replaced in the center space and gave the heat. And upon those heated rocks was poured the fresh water and sprinkled the sweet grass to make the purification of the Swent Lodge. Only a woman could tend the fire. Only men would sit in the Swent Lodge circle. That the reciprocality would not be known whatsoever if you looked at one function or the other. One had to view the larger ecology of the whole and to get the connection. The same as in the large form of the sun dance, the whole apex of the sun dance was always that some man held up by all the men in the tribe was able to exemplify the courage of self-sacrifice in order for life to go on for the tribe. But that all of that male courage of self-sacrifice was held into an effective form by a single holy woman. The holy woman of that sun dance. The holy woman, holy because she had made a vow in midwinter to give a sun dance in midsummer. And had fasted for that whole half year so that when midsummer came, she had from midwinter on kept her vow pure and her prayer continuous. So that she was able to keep a spiritual fire tended, so that the spiritual matter from that fire could be carried to the center of the spirit of the men, and they were able to be an effective whole. So that early anthropologists who looked in as outsiders on the sun dance saw the masculine courage as the center of the whole ceremony and didn't understand that without the linchpin of the holy woman's sacredness and fasting, the male form was ineffective. And that the connective in between the two was always a visionary spirit for the man who made the sacrifice. It came into the ritual form of an eagle bone whistle, the only sound he could make in his anguish. They would take the flesh of the shoulders, and pierce it with a piece of antler, and tie wet rawhide thongs from those antler tips to the top of the Sundance Lodge, and in the dance, the heat of the sun, as the rawhide dried, there was more and more tension until finally the only way to relieve the tension was to break free by breaking the rawhide cords or by ripping the flesh. And the only sound of pain he could make was his wind coming out of the eagle wing bone, which makes a sound very much like an eagle. But without the holy woman keeping the vision of the eagle sacred, the man's cry for courage would not be heard, and he would fail. It took later anthropologists like Gladys Reichardt or Ruth Benedict or Margaret Mead, women anthropologists, especially of the American school, there were many geniuses, American women anthropologists, who finally understood the whole form and why it was that the reciprocality of the genders as a whole made that ritual sacred and made it work. And we will see that this is characteristic of the world of ritual. It's characteristic of the way in which a societal form is bonded and held in fertility. And that without this exchange, without this reciprocality, without this cooperativeness, the forms were not bonded, they did not hold, fertility would be a curse rather than a blessing. Now let's come back and review. Let's review something. Let's review some very powerful observations that will form the basis of some very powerful concepts and ideas later on, towards the end of the year when we get into ideas, when we get into the powers of thought. We'll see that the powers of thought have efficacy because they are founded, they grow out of the powers of feeling. That the powers of feeling are intelligent roots of the powers of thought. One of the great philosophic minds of the 20th century, a woman named Suzanne Langer, wrote in one of her books on the philosophy of mind, philosophy of art, she said, "I'm scouting the possibility that thought is an elaboration of feeling. And that without being able to feel distinctly, one could never think clearly. And that feeling is a vibrational resonance of the body. And so there's a direct diametrical diameter line of connection between the body and the mind. Why, in order to think clearly, do yogas assume asanas? Why should positions of the body affect the clarity of thought? Because they are linked together as two points, not on a simple circle, but as two locations on a whole sphere. And that those locations on that sphere are there because they are real as long as the sphere is real. And their polarization is a polarization of a diameter line along the plane of the diameter, but their complementation is a function of the trigonometric sphere as a whole. And so as long as you are dealing only with a plane through the sphere, and thus only with the circle, will two opposing points seem to be polarities. But as soon as you take the entire sphere into consideration and transcend the diameter plane, those two points then become complementations to an almost infinite array of pairs. It's tantamount to someone thinking that they could characterize the ritual movement of life by astrology. Astrology is limited to the plane of the ecliptic, limited to the sun's movement in the sky, a simple plane. And that the Libra and the Aries is two points polarized on that circle of the zodiac could somehow characterize anything more than a brute level of reactiveness, whereas the entire sphere of the sky, in the same parlance of the 12 constellations of the zodiac, there were classically 88 constellations of the sphere of the heavens. Just like there were 88 keys to the piano because of the series of octaves. Just like the Japanese character for rice contains the radical 88 because this rice has come through 88 hands to you. Indications of an enormous ecology of truth, that the complication of life is vast and yet there in a discernible form, that though the gestalt is almost transcendent, it nevertheless is intuitively graspable. But that the grasping of it is not at all on the level of image. because an image is like a point on a plane delimited by some kind of geometrical form, like a circle. Whereas as soon as that image is seen in terms of the whole sphere and all of its ecology of relationality, the image becomes symbolic, becomes a symbol. And the power of a trigonometric symbol is enormously expanded from a geometrical image. And yet the geometrical image is indispensable because it's the seed out of which grows the trigonometric symbol. And indeed, having just the trigonometric symbol is only the beginning of a whole new world, the world of differential intelligence, which goes in vision far beyond what would be the normal community of nature. And man inhabits realms that in nature would only be surreal, and yet for him are home. Let's come back and review a couple of statements that we had earlier this morning based on Jane Goodall's observations of chimpanzees, for example. That nutrition and sexual cycles form a paired combination, the phase form movements of which bond together a ritual year, an annual year, even on level of early primates like chimpanzees, or should say simple primates like chimpanzees. And that sexual polarity in existence seeks integration through exchange. And that if this exchange is not possible, then on the one hand, the male conflict capacity goes unchecked, and the female osmotic capacity goes unchecked. And one has, on one hand, a delimitation which is debilitating, and on the other hand, a limitation which is debilitating. And the entire structure of sociological possibility, just on simple level of chimpanzees, is not sustainable. The community would not be able to sustain itself. So that in ritual, there will be a reciprocity structure based upon this exchange, and that the exchange not only is on basis of gender fertility, but extended of gender exploration into each other's realms, and on level of nutrition being able to be shared beyond simple survival. And that this ritual reciprocity shows itself distinctly, is earmarked, is dog-tagged, is radioactively able to be traced, so that when language as a process comes into play, it naturally, it ritually, it mythically develops into words which can be exchanged rather than limits itself to exclamations which can only be yelled by one person for themselves. That language is words of exchange, sources of conversation, seeds of dialogue, rather than just expanded yells, rather than just beefed up interjections. So that far from language beginning by grunts and moans, language begins by communication from the very beginning. And language, far from being primitive, is already very sophisticated level. And since language is the energy body by which feeling is carried, we are now in a position to be ready to learn something really enormously important. As what is the true structure of feeling? And how can we learn, how can we educate ourselves and communicate with each other about the intelligence of feeling in such a way that it can be taught, it can be shared, it can be learned, that it's not all happenstance, but that there is an educational design available. And should it come as any surprise whatsoever that feeling has its own intelligent forms, have you never heard any music? Music is intelligible feeling without philosophical argumentation. No one has to use any kind of symbolic order. The feeling is there. Even when symbolic music was being developed almost fanatically after Beethoven, when symbolic music in the hands of someone like Richard Wagner was being developed at this torrid, fervent pace, Wagner, in order to use intelligible feeling embodied in musical form, used musical motifs to carry specific and exact feelings repeatable in all different sorts of compositions. So that in the overture to Die Meistersinger, one finds very similar kinds of motifs to the development later on, say, in Siegfried's Forest Murmurings. But they're recognizable. Why? Simply because Richard Wagner put them there? No. He put them there because he discovered, like many geniuses after Beethoven, that a whole field of intelligible experimental inquiry had been opened up. And not only because Beethoven was so able to put feeling into musical form, he learned from Mozart a great many of the developments that later on were developed. And Mozart, in all this precociousness and individual genius, kept an ear open to Papa Haydn at the same time. And both of them understood structure that had come because Bach, the senior Bach, the J.S. Bach, was able to put musical structure into such laser-like in-phase progressions that the feelings that were natural to them emerged for first time. And that old grandfather Bach learned all that because he listened with really close, attentive, late 16th century Germanic plodding plainness to hear exactly what was there and nothing else. And when he listened to and read the notation of things like Gregorian chant or Palestrina, he saw exactly what was there, that musical forms are as exact as any logic you ever want to have. And if you have those musical forms put into, let's say, the gestalt of a fugue, where a counterpoint is working as a bass, and you have a melodic line working with that, those structures carry exacting feelings best. It's just like the structure of the DNA molecule, where one of the helixes goes down and the other helix goes up, because if they don't cooperate in this way, the structure would not hold. So that when you look at the structure of a DNA molecule, you have to have two turns of the helical structure in order to get the whole thing. You can't have just one oblate vesica piscis-like form, but you have to have two together. It's like a figure eight. It's like an hourglass, like an infinity sign. It's like a double attractor. It's like the very form in which the universe discloses actuality. That actuality always occurs in this way. Why? Because if it didn't, it wouldn't occur. It does not matter how many dimensions of whatever farthest surreal kind of universe you can imagine, none of them, check the box, zero, nil, zip, none of them would be existent without going through this form. That even the development of antimatter, atoms, must follow in this form, in their contraternary form. So that at CERN or Fermilab, where for a handful of nanoseconds, antimatter atoms are contained, 40 billionths of a second there, they have an existential form which follows the same principles as the forms of matter. And on n dimensions, whatever the dimensionality of existence, this form holds all the way through to us and beyond wherever we're going to go. So that an education that really is able to do something must have this kind of limpid, clear, intelligent substrate constantly active and working. Otherwise, the data, the information, the stuff is not going to hold in any kind of form that's useful whatsoever. It's not going to do anybody any good. So that there is a universality that's here. We learn from, in this case today, Jane Goodall's study of chimpanzees, someone who, like Papa Bach, who sat there long enough to see what's there, what happens, and also to notice what does not happen. What comes out of that is a recognition that for males, transgression is a trigger of conflict. You sin, you die, is typical kind of necessity for that particular gender. Yet, that which is not an attitude, but which is a basic fundamental ritual comportment towards the process of a sexual organic existence would be so self-limiting that only one generation of males would live. It would be self-destructive immediately within that generation. So that something counters that, something mitigates that. And what mitigates that is the female's recognition that though transformation is a natural jeopardy, though it's a ritual danger, and on later human level, women understanding that it's a mythic surreality, nevertheless, and even though it might be symbolically incomprehensible, nevertheless, transformation is necessary to life. With all that, with a shopping list that is staggers, the male, the female, still goes shopping. Still does it. And so this kind of mitigation of the one with the other forms a situation where, from time to time, even though the matrix of organic sexuality is often out of phase, totally out of phase, totally scattered, nevertheless, from time to time, from moment to moment, in phase situations happen, and fertility occurs right there. And that the resonance of that in-phase fertility is not simply for procreation, but extends itself to the sociological realm, even level of chimpanzees. The males learn something new they would never have known. The females learn something new they would never have known. And as a consequence, there's a richness, even on level of chimpanzee community, which extends not just to the community. One of the italicized conclusions at the end of her great Harvard study is that even with chimpanzees, you cannot study a single community and have anything viable scientifically. You must study the system of social groups. That the basic unit of social organization is never a single group. There's no such thing as an atomic sociology, even on the level of chimpanzees. It's the ecology of the entire system of the social groups interacting in a given area, and one can expand the givenness of the area almost indefinitely. So that when you're looking to understand an organic form like man, you might need a whole planet, or you might need, as I've been suggesting, that you need minimally, in order to study a being like us, an entire star system. That the geographical area that's commensurate with the capacities of this kind of life form is a star system. And that if you've been studying it nation by nation, or tribe by tribe, no wonder no one has got anywhere. We still haven't seen the form in its natural setting. We have still seen males get territoriality out of city streets. Hey, it's our turf, man. You drive here, you pay. Breathe our air, no teeth. Hey, it's our alley. Yeah. That kind of attitude inherits the dead-end alleys. That's where it finally collects and resides. Whereas the obverse of that is an explosion of creative exploration and finding out and learning that leads beyond the Kuiper Belt, not to the Oort cloud, about a light year on every direction from here, whole spherical direction from here. That on level of a star system, our kind of being for the first time becomes seeable as a species in its true habitat. That whatever is beyond us is beyond star system size. And we shouldn't yak too much about what's beyond us till we fill out our own shoes, at least that far. If we got busy and rolled up our sleeves, it would take us at least 200 years of creative pell-mell genius to get to inhabit the star system. Just the star system. It's actually a very small star system. About 46 light years from here is a star system that includes a planet about 6.5 times the size of Jupiter, just for openers. There are all kinds of star systems beyond count and number. Our particular organic life form until we inhabit this star system needs to learn a lot with great gulps of silence and great humility of exchange. This education looks at it in this way. If we limit ourselves to a countable, an accountable, countable numeracy of arithmetic delimitation, calibrated by supposed identities, we are trapped on a male projective level that's even exceeded by chimpanzees. What in the hell are we doing? I've heard of regressions, but that's a little overdone, isn't it? And of course, one of the rules of progression, regressions, sort of a Jungian slip there. One of the rules of regressions is that you do not go back to the median of the previous form, but you go back to the lowest rung. So one doesn't even regress back to chimpanzees, but the lowest rung, and the lowest rung of organic forms is like below flatworms. And so one finds peculiar situation of scintillating spiritual geniuses acting like sub-flatworms. More next week on a different tone. Now, next week's an interval, so next week has nothing to do with nature, it has nothing to do with ritual, but is an interval. It's like a musical interval. And we're going to take the Tao Te Ching so that the punctuation of that interval is an interface which allows for nature to come to some kind of a pause and for ritual to not yet have stepped out. Thank you.